University of Colorado at Boulder. I'd like to thank all of you for rising bright and early this morning for this panel on regime change and money, uncertain futures, part one. I'd also like to thank Julia Duthwaite for organizing us and for sending out a call for papers that resulted not just in one panel, but two, and two interdisciplinary panels at that. It's always great to get a nice mix of not just historians, but literature specialists as well. Our first presenter this morning is Tabitha Ewing. She is an associate professor of history at Bard College and currently a fellow at the New York Institute for Humanities at NYU. Recipient of numerous honors and awards, including a Fulbright Fellowship to France and a Ford Foundation Doctoral Fellowship, Tabitha received her PhD in history from Princeton University in 2005. She is the author, most notably, of Rumor, Diplomacy, and War in the Enlightenment in Paris, which was published in 2014 by the Voltaire Foundation as part of its Oxford University Studies in the Enlightenment series. And she is currently working on a second book project, Extradition in the Age of Kings, of Runaway Wives, Fugitive Slaves, Spies, Counterfeiters, and Dissident Writers. Her paper this morning is entitled False Coinage in an 18th Century Borderland. Thank you.
So I'll stand up just because it's more fun. So thank you very much, Matthew. And that introduction, especially the book project title, is the project from which this current paper is drawn. This is new-ish research. I just completed some time in the archives at Liège, and which was an interesting experience, and wonderful, amazing experience, and then in Brussels. And that follows up on diplomatic research that I had done in Paris that sort of corresponds with the sort of judicial papers and diplomatic papers that I found, state papers that I found in the other places. Okay, so my current research is on the forms of political subjectivity prior to and without assuming any telos of modern citizenship. Individuals did not live coherently within a single legal framework of statist rights and prohibitions that overrode all others in early modern, in the early modern period. Rather, these individuals and less individuated subjects navigated through multiple jurisdictions and overlapping legal regimes. While this condition characterized life within any given city, kingdom, or imperial outpost, my larger project focuses on extradition as a way to study relations between neighboring political entities, France and others, and certain types of individuals who cross their borders. It explores relationships of scale, the local, the imperial, the international, and what kinds of rights were reclaimable at different levels or between levels. Today I look at the counterfeiter, based in the Principality Bishopric of Liège, a figure that who excited intense communications between the governments of France and Liège. Again, I'm using judicial and diplomatic archives, both in France and Liège, and today I'll talk about, well, refer to three cases and focus on one in particular. The first case involves the investigation and sentencing of Marie-Joseph Joris, also known as the widow du Tillieu, who was currently, at the time, married to Pierre Hamelot. So she has three names, Marie-Joseph, and by the way, there are many Marie-Josephs for some reason in this, seriously, many in this story, which is the first time I've ever seen that. And she was in Dinan, but her case was heard ultimately in the court of Liège. Archivists highlight this case in the inventory of city councilors' trials for the numerous witness interrogations that provided information into the production and diffusion of fake money. Initially, the interest her case held for my larger project was as comparison among what today we would call domestic, foreign, and international procedures. Just how important was place to the practice of coining and its punishment? Relatedly, still thinking in modern terms, since formal extradition required that both sovereign states consider the act a crime, today that's the case in the case, my reasoning for studying her case and others like it was more instrumental. So a subsidiary question to my inquiry became whether, and if so how, the criminality of counterfeiting in Liège influenced official readiness to surrender counterfeiters to France. Marie-Joseph's circulation of false coin came to light through the complaint brought by Jacques Brasseur, who was not a Brasseur. He was a bourgeois of Dinan, and he was accompanied by a soldier named Jacquet in the service of Her Imperial Majesty. Having arrived at Marie-Joseph's residence in order to force her to give over an escalin, the coin of Liège, engraved with the arms of His Serene Highness the Cardinal Jean-Théodore de Bavière, the coin she had given Brasseur's wife the previous evening to pay for the bread Joris had purchased from her. So it turned out to be a fake coin, and he went to her house, stormed her house, in fact, and insisted that she give him the equivalent in good money. Brasseur sought out an exchange of good money for bad, but then she threw the coins, when she drew coins from her pocket, Jacquet and Brasseur noticed that some of those were defective, quote-unquote, as well. A bit of violence ensued with an attempt to dispose of the incriminating objects, that is, she threw them in the face of Jacquet, and her flight into the adjoining residence where her daughter from her first marriage and stepson lived. They were married. City officials returned to conduct a search and seizure, finding pieces of alloyed copper and silver, along with other denominations of false coin. Marie-Joseph was placed in the Conciergerie de Saint-Jacques, while a special court in Dinan was assembled immediately to decide her case, according to the letter and spirit of the Mondement of 13 November 1719 and the 18th of March 1726, both stringent criminal codes concerning financial crimes. But due to differences of opinion, it seems like, I don't have a really good explanation, officials in the city of Dinan passed this case on to the city councilors of Liège. Witness testimony and Joris' own responses under interrogation reveal the geography of counterfeiting as being quite local. The boulanger on the Rue des Fossés was one place where she went early in the evening to buy bread, and there the boulanger refused her coin, saying that it was a fake. Later she went to the boulanger on the Rue des Trois Escabelles, where she'd stopped in and she doesn't name the baker. But later to the boulanger, the widow Thierry, where she did buy something. She stopped by the L'Enfis family to buy salt, 5 liards worth, which she paid with an escalin de la reine. Marie-Joseph recalled having payment for bread refused a month earlier by the widow Thierry, who wanted to show the coin to an expert, an orfèvre. Marie-Joseph refused, and recovering the coin, insisted she would return it to the person who gave it to her, a stranger. She went to the tobacconist, Pierre Robert, known as the Petit Pierre on the Grande Rue. She claims not to have visited Henri Bussin, boulanger on the Rue Saint-Pierre, nor to have purchased anything from Saint-Martin, the marchand épicier near the Jesuits. She recalled paying for the firewood her husband had picked up the day before at Monsieur Dutise's. Witnesses confirmed that Joris, or woman wearing a head wrap that covered her almost entirely, purchased butter from Monsieur Martin, bread from Monsieur Bussin, and fatefully, the wife of Monsieur Brasseur, using false coin. Turning to the witness testimony, actually, I was mostly borrowing from her responses. The witnesses say something slightly differently, as I've already indicated. Witnesses indicated that even when confronted, Joris managed to keep the false coin in local circulation and make her regular purchases. That is, that's my summation of what they're saying, until her arrest. Marie-Joseph Brasseur, this is not the same Marie-Joseph, who is the boulanger, described having recognized the coin as fake by biting down on it to see if it bent. When she did, Joris snatched it back. Marie-Joseph Robert, that's the daughter of the tobacconist, remembered an older woman who was well covered purchasing a small amount of tobacco that she paid with escalin de 10 sols, against which the shop girl returned a coin worth 9.5 sols. She later recognized the coin as fake, gave it to her father, who took it to a surgeon, Baudson, who was to deliver it to a city official. And if this surgeon, Baudson, is related to the family, to a city councilor, you can see why he would want to give it to the surgeon, who would then give it safely to the city official without being himself, the father tobacconist, being implicated. Jeanne-Joseph Jacquet, wife of Jacques Brasseur, who brought forward a complaint, only saw the accused in disguise. However, her sister visited soon after, saying that the old lady was in fact Mademoiselle Dutilleux, that is our Joris, who was referred to by the name of her first husband. When the transaction happened, Jeanne's husband and brother were out. Her husband asked when he came home if she'd sold anything. She said yes, a loaf of bread at 10 sols. She gave the coin to her brother, who gave her the equivalent, and then showed the coin to her husband. Then her sister-in-law came in, and they all found that it bent easily. Now, you can picture this family meeting where they're all testing the coin by putting it in their mouth. So after that family conference, Brasseur and Jacquet descended on Joris for payment. Catherine Servet, the widow Thierry, identified Joris, her regular customer, easily. The latter had presented a pièce de deux escalins de la reine, but Catherine suspected the alloy was off and told Joris that she would take the piece to the silversmith Jaumon. But Joris took it back, saying that someone was waiting for it back at her place, and with that, she left without the bread and with the coin. The tailor, François Bourrel, knew Joris well and said that she purchased small items from him, always paying with good coin. Catherine Lonfils recalled that the prisoner wanted to exchange a louis au soleil, that is French coin, for 19 florins, but Catherine was only prepared to offer 18 florins with 16 patards, that is 18 florins, 16 patards. Likewise, Anne-Marie Thomas had at various times sold wood to the prisoner, who paid with good money. But on one occasion, Joris wanted to pay with a louis d'or au soleil at 19 florins 10 sols, which the witness refused as too expensive. Joris's son, Guillaume, returned and paid mostly with pièces de deux escalins that Thomas took to be correct and spent them, she said, with no problem. Anne-Marie Thomas had heard from the wife of a local master brewer, Nicolas Bourguignon, that one of the prisoner's children gave an escalin to one of Bourguignon's children, a boy of about 9 years old, to buy some bread. The baker refused the coin, believing it to be fake, and the child brought the coin back home where Joris's son recovered it, saying that someone in another village gave it to him, again another stranger. Several witnesses pointed out that Joris's grandson, Xavier, worked for a silver or goldsmith, and he was heard to have said, in Dinan, making fake money has always been done. Marie-Joseph Joris, that's our Marie-Joseph, was tortured for about an hour so that she would name her accomplices, then hanged in a public place where her corpse was to caution local folk from following her example before she was to be buried in unconsecrated ground. The prince pardoned her corpse so it might avoid that fate. The summation of Barthélemy Thibault, one of the officers of Dinan, was that the crime for which Marie-Joseph Joris was indicted, the crime of false coining, concerned the sovereign personally and was an attack on regal rights. Again, an expression that I don't think you see in French, but was in Liégeois French at the time, his droit régaux. And that tolerance of this would be pernicious to the well-being of the Principality of Liège. It would seem then that at every crossroad, her case turned inward, retracing local parameters of daily commerce and local political life. That is, I think, the important comparative takeaway in relation to counterfeiting cases that come out of the diplomatic archives is this, that in her case, it was quite local. That typically was not the case, or that is to say, that was not the case based on the research that I do in diplomatic archives. Nevertheless, a careful review of the files reveals certain complexities. The first is of a territory situated between two great powers as a part of the Holy Roman Empire and with strong historic and geographical ties to France. The coins of those great powers circulated as local currency in Joyce's world. The pièce de deux escalins de la reine, referring to the Dowager Queen Empress Maria Theresa, and the louis d'or au soleil to France. The Mondermont of 1719 and 1726, signaling changes to the penal code, were drafted largely in reaction to pressure applied by France directly or indirectly through the offices of the Holy Roman Emperor. While the sovereignty jurisprudenced was stated as that of the Prince Bishop of Liège, the trial shifted from the administration of the city of Dinan to that of the city councillors of Liège. Other judicial instruments existed that depended solely or more closely on the prince bishop, so that city and principality were sometimes in jurisdictional conflict. Further research, therefore, may reveal that the appeal to the Liège courts reflected something of an international character between the two cities, that is, as two distinct political entities. So might, therefore, the illicit fabrication of money, an object in and of communication that affirmed the discreteness of the two entities. Speculation aside, foreign coin migrated across borders and served as something like legal tender, making it the quintessential transnational object, muddying political boundaries. A certain figure of the counterfeiter was a transnational subject. Coin was iconic, bearing the graven images of kings in arms, but it was also malleable in that its value was negotiated on site, sometimes in the very moment of exchange, and meltable. Recoignement seems to have been a word current across the French frontier, used by those who made illicit profit from fluctuating monetary values, especially those instigated by the French crown through successive devaluations early in the century. It is striking that a royal declaration in 1715 proposed to punish to death French nationals, renicoles, and foreigners, wherever they might reside, who minted coin without authorization. The colorful case of Nicolas Canto of Liège, which has been written about by a few scholars of counterfeiting, reveals the investigative and judicial procedures for convicting a foreigner in his own home. Canto was at the center of a counterfeiting ring in the first quarter of the 18th century. Aristocrats, priests, maidservants, currency traders, bankers, and metal workers populated his network. Canto's situation was complicated by his status as a religious, leading the already disinclined Liégeois authorities to delay and then forego capital punishment by ceding to the Pope's authority in such cases. French officials, especially those tied to the Cour des Monnaies, maintained an interest in Canto's fate down to and beyond his accidental death in roughly 1742. In addition to the details of French and Liégeois procedures, his case interests me in the terms his advocates used to justify his work, focused largely on the impoverishment France's currency fluctuations caused within neighboring states. Canto had a French-born associate, Joseph Pierson of Bouillon. France's negotiations with Brussels and Liège to bring him to justice look more familiar to the modern eye as extradition. At one point, Pierson argued during the interrogation that he had received approbation for his activities from a priest, not Canto, who had indicated that while it was certainly illegal recoining money with just proportions of precious metals was not immoral. So illegal, but not immoral. Here, the multifarious forms of valuation, commodity, exchange, and fixed value, became the source of a flexible moral calculation. I'm struck here by the sense that figures like Pierson interpolated the state rather than the other way around, and here I'm just thinking out loud, engaged in a form of doubling and inversion in a transnational, transjurisdictional borderland, counterfeiters called upon the state to refine the relationship of sovereignty to publicness in theory and in practice. I've got to think that through a little bit more, but I think that's right. For all that Canto and Pierson's cases take up reams of paper, the reader learns little of their everyday lives as compared to Marie-Joseph Joris. As a point of similarity, Joris wore a disguise. Pierson changed his name a couple of times, probably three times. Joris's activities seem to have been confined to her neighborhood. Pierson's connections went from Amsterdam to Antwerp to Luxembourg to Brussels and Paris. The geography of counterfeiting for Pierson et al. Was mapped not only by long distances, but by literate correspondence and the post. Much larger sums of money were involved, and the financial instruments for laundering fake money were far more sophisticated than those employed by Joris. Joyce was executed. Canto had his sentence commuted to life in prison, and Pierson seemed to have disappeared. Joyce's crime was an injury to the sovereignty of the prince. Pierson and Canto, French officials complained, were criminal disturbers of the trade between nations. Their criminal commerce was equally contrary to the rights of sovereigns as to the society of nations. Punishment was for the public good. The crime was public theft. And a critical variant, the crime was in causing a diminution of public confidence in specie. I'll stop there and say simply this, that in studying all of these cases together, and many, many more, part of what I'm trying to look at is how the international itself is being conceptualized. And we read about international law or early international law, and we think of extradition as something that exists in the age of states, that is a 19th century development, and that's largely true. But in fact, there were these incidences, and sometimes the word extradition was used itself, although not terribly often in French. So part of what I'm looking at is the very conceptualization of the international and what the contexts are in which that occurs. So I'll stop there and hope to take your questions.